This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In a northern suburb of Baghdad last Friday night, an electrical transformer blew up, plunging the neighborhood into darkness. U.S. soldiers, apparently fearing a bomb attack, went on alert. Within 45 minutes, six Iraqis trying to get home before the 11 p.m. curfew were shot and killed by U.S. troops. 36-year-old Anwar Kazaa lost her husband and three of her four children. In an article in the Associated Press, she's quoted as saying, "We kept shouting, 'We're a family, don't shoot.' But no one listened. They kept shooting," said Kazaa, who is expecting another child this month. When asked about the shootings, Lieutenant Colonel Guy Shields, a spokesman for the coalition forces, said, quote, "Our checkpoints are usually marked and our soldiers are trained and disciplined. I will check on that. That is serious," unquote. Confronted by daily guerrilla attacks that have killed 56 Americans since May 1st, U.S. troops are on edge. As we speak, Stan Goff's son is heading for Iraq as part of the 82nd Airborne Division to replace the embattled 3rd Infantry Division. Goff is different from most parents waiting at home for words from their loved ones. Goff is a veteran and on the coordinating committee of Bring 'Em Home Now, a campaign of veterans and military families that has sprung up in the face of continuing conflict in what has become an occupation of Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with Goff today about his advocacy and what shaped his decision to call for the return of U.S. troops from Iraq.
Essentially, the 3rd Infantry Division has been exhausted as a fighting force. They've been over there for too long. The circumstances have been too harsh, and now they're having difficulty maintaining their morale and their discipline. And it's also, you know, translated into a great deal of dissent at home on the part of their families.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the implication of some of the things that were being reported, you know, that and these morale and discipline problems show up in all sorts of different ways.
What sort of morale and discipline problems?
The troops are so exhausted and operating in circumstances that are so difficult right now. And the circumstances are militarily and politically sort of impossible circumstances. They've been ordered into a position by people who really don't understand those circumstances to do something that is probably not doable, and that's pacify and control a population that doesn't want them there.
When you say people that don't understand, are you talking about the Bush administration?
Oh, yeah.
Military officials?
That's exactly what I'm talking mm-hmm. about.
Have you spoken with other families of soldiers currently serving in Iraq, and can you speak about what they've told you about the group you've formed called Bring 'Em Home Now?
Well, yes, it's Bring 'Em Home Now, and it's not a group, it's a campaign. And we're in the process of mobilizing people from both military families groups and veterans groups around that campaign. Military Families Speak Out was one of the core groups. Veterans for Peace is a core group. We've also got a relationship in this campaign now with the GI Rights Hotline and some other folks. They have about 600 families in the organization already.
Mm-hmm.
Of people who, many people who sort of bought the official line initially, but as the official stories begun to fall apart, people have begun to question not only the wisdom, but the morality of using their children and their spouses. They told us there was a threat to the people of the United States, and now we're finding out there are no weapons of mass destruction, there's no nuclear program, there are no chemical and biological shells ready to fire on 45 minutes' notice, no ties with Al-Qaeda, you know, and so they changed the story. They said, well, we weren't looking for weapons, we were looking for a weapons program, that kind of thing. As their legitimacy, as their credibility falls apart, this is what's really changing people's minds. My experience in the military, and I was in the military for about 24 years, I retired from 3rd Special Forces in February 96. And my experience is that troops, if they're convinced of the necessity of their task, can display a very powerful, a fierce fighting spirit, even in the harshest of circumstances. But if they're faced, as the troops in Iraq are now, mm-hmm. with this unremitting hostility from the majority of a population they were told would welcome them as liberators, and then those official reasons for the invasion are sort of systematically proven to have been a pack of lies, essentially, then their morale is going to plummet, and that's what's happening. And discipline will follow morale down that slope in the same way that Rumsfeld and Bush misread the Iraqi reaction to the invasion, probably because Rumsfeld and Bush let their own arrogance and their sort of ignorant racial stereotyping delude them. They've also let their stereotyping of troops based on their disdain of working people, working class people, led them to believe that the troops to just, you know, could be continually, you know, indefinitely cheered on with slogans, and that the troops themselves weren't capable of recognizing stage management and lies. But, I mean, my own experience is troops are quite capable of critical thinking, and they recognize lies and hypocrisy probably more quickly than the rest of us do because they're confronted with them firsthand.
Are you saying that a portion of the troops or the majority of the troops are starting to feel as though they've been duped by the Bush administration into serving in a war or a situation that is quite different from the way that the administration characterized it? And if so, you know, what percentage of the troops have that feeling, that sentiment, share that sentiment, and what is being done about it?
I don't think there's any way for us to quantify that. You know, obviously we're too far from the action. I think what we have to do is sort of infer from different things what's going on. We have the emails and the letters coming home from the troops and so forth. Tell you what was really the watershed for me was when, for a couple of days, as the press began to roam around and talk to troops, you started having troops, and these weren't new troops. Some of them were sergeants who were saying, yeah, I have a pack of cards, and my aces are George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Pearl. You have to sort of understand what a military environment is like to understand the implication of someone saying something like that on national television or to an international press agency. Only someone under really severe personal, physical, and psychological pressure that's going to be willing to sort of step across those boundaries like that. And when Bush made that idiotic remark about bring them on from the comfort of a White House press office, there was a letter that came back from a troop to one of the people we corresponded with, and he said that virtually every single member of his company was offended by that. So this is not saying that these troops have all, you know, moved to some thoroughgoing systemic and critical consciousness of the war or geopolitics or anything else. But again, it does tell you that they recognize the hypocrisy of it, and that's what's undermining morale. There's sort of this Orwellian thing going on now where the very people who have destroyed the morale of these troops are now accusing us of destroying their morale by asking to bring them back home.
Well, are the troops disciplined when they speak out in that manner? Do they fear that their families will face repercussions from their being so candid?
I think it's the other way around. What happened was in Fort Stewart, Georgia, when it was military families who staged a minor rebellion against one of the cheerleading sessions organized by the post commander, the brass at Fort Stewart made an implicit threat to the families that their activities could have a negative impact on their spouses and families' careers, you see. I mean, when the troops made those comments over in Iraq, the CENTCOM commander was on the television the following day basically saying, if you have no right to speak in such a manner, you have no right to criticize your chain of command, and if you do it again, we'll unleash the full force, the Uniform Code of Military Justice on you.
I'd like to hear what that would be, but also, so did those families experience any kind of jeopardy or harm to their military careers? I guess it's still too early in the game to really know.
Yeah, it is, and I think over time we'll see more and more of this stuff trickle out. What's interesting now is the way that these families are beginning to discover and connect with this nascent Bring Them Home Now campaign. One of the things that we intend to do in the course of this campaign, we've already set that up as sort of communications infrastructure for the campaign, is we have a website. So if people do fear that they will be personally targeted for speaking out and they still have something to say, we're going to make sure that they have an avenue to express themselves, and we'll protect people's identities if necessary. But if military families have something to say, or even if active duty people have something to say, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice may tell people that they can't violate operational security, which is common sense, and it also says that they have to limit their criticism of the chain of command. But there's some other things that the UCMJ also says. It says that they don't have to follow an illegal order. you know, those kinds of things. So one of the things we're also going to do is link families and military people up with people like the GI Rights Hotline, the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force, and other people who can advise them on their rights, because I think what's going on now is the military is just sort of trying to do, you know, you've heard it before, this notion of chilling the atmosphere for communication without being too specific or without overstepping themselves, and just hoping that that atmosphere of inhibition will keep people from speaking out.
Now,
and we intend to counter that and not commit any hostile act, and that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything about plans to reduce imminent danger pay and absent from family benefits for U.S. soldiers?
You know, and here's the very same people who accuse us, because we want to bring our families back someplace where it's safe, of undermining morale, are the very ones who are nickel-diming these veterans' benefits. This administration has attempted to cut combat pay. They're in the process of systematically eroding GIs and veterans' benefits. And at the same time, you know, they seem to be writing a blank check to Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and all these other people to build their killer drones and all their other little high-tech war toys. You know, one of the things that I try to emphasize to people who don't understand, people within the military, you know, the military spends a lot of time trying to confer some status on people to make them feel good about what they're doing. But the minute they're done with you, they forget about you. And, you know, the reality is that the bean counters in the Pentagon and in the Veterans Administration really regard the human beings who are in the military as simply more equipment.
Mm-hmm.
When they use them up, they go find some more.
It's been reported that there's a petition, which is an effort to require Congress to reapply Section 622 to the House Resolution 1588 that allows for continued payment of imminent danger and family separation pay.
I think that probably has a very strong chance of succeeding, to stop them from taking those benefits away. If they cut the combat pay and they cut the family separation pay, this administration, which seems to have a real talent for undermining itself and destroying its own credibility, will have taken that to a whole new level.
I have heard occasional stories about suicides among the troops. What can you tell us about that?
Well, again, I'm here and they're there. We know that some of these casualties are suicides, and there are ones that they're calling non-combat casualties, as if these troops would have committed suicide had they been home with their families. And we know there's been a number of them. And they're being referred to as a non-combat discharge of a firearm, which, you know, could mean an accidental discharge, or it could mean a suicide. This, again, what strikes me about this whole conjuncture, ever since 9/11 and this administration's push to go sort of recolonize Central and Southwest Asia, has been the way that they twist language. They're calling something that's, you know, something that's obviously not a disease with an organic etiology, pneumonia, even though there are no disease clusters to indicate that this is something that's communicable by some sort of an organism. And so far as I can tell, they're not even looking at the issue of this cocktail of untested inoculations that are given to the troops, exposure to depleted uranium. You see, because the process has to be constructed in a way so that the military can't be held liable.
Stan Goff is a retired master sergeant, the parent of a soldier serving now in the Army, a war veteran, and he's on the coordinating committee of the advocacy group Bring Them Home Now. Their website is bringthemhomenow.org.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. it's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't a marching anymore. No, I ain't a marching anymore.
Phil Oakes, I Ain't Marching Anymore. According to the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, more than 2,000 people have been detained since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. They're mostly Arab, Muslim, and South Asian men who were apprehended as part of the Justice Department's investigation into the attacks or for simple immigration violations. Justice Department officials have refused to disclose numbers, identities, or locations of those detained. Families of the detainees, legal advocates, and civil liberties organizations are still struggling to obtain information about the detainees, as well as the many who have been deported. One such person is Waleed Hanim, who's been working legally in the U.S. since 1997, but is scheduled to be deported on Tuesday. Peace Watch correspondent Reem Kadhuda from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington brings us his story.
The oppression of African Americans spills over into how recently immigrated Egyptians and other Arabs are treated by the Immigration and Naturalization Services. Waleed Ghanem is an Egyptian who moved to the United States 9 years ago, got married 7 years ago, and has 3 children. Ghanem is asked to report for deportation on Tuesday. Here is his story.
My name is Waleed Ali Abdullah Ghanem. My story starts from the beginning at 95. A man confirmed me and he told me he's a lawyer and he was willing to help me to give me a green card and the legal status. And I kind of, you know, just find it is okay, you know, everything will be easy. I don't know what he did. I just signed some paper. At that time, I was in the United States more than 8 months. And pretty much the English reading or understanding, it wasn't that well with me. He brings some applications, and the only things I did, he just let me sign at the signature place, and the rest of the application was blank. I didn't know what this application for or anything. After that, the month, and he went with me to the INS building, and they issued a work permit for me, and I kind of just felt kind of, you know, secure. Everything is from over there, so they will be eligible. He said his fee is $2,000 and I have to pay another $5,000. It's like a pack taxes because I was working for a couple months, you know, with no work permit. I agree about it, and after everything, I got it in my hand. By the end of the same year, 95, the INS people came to my house asking me how did I get his work permit. And they asked me to stop by their office downtown to explain everything. I went the next day and explained everything, and what had happened is that guy was running like some kind of scam. They kept my passport, the old passport, and they told me they cannot give it to me because they got some of the false stamps on it, fake stamp. They let me go. They told me you've been a victim of a fraudulent marriage, and you're ready to go, and you don't have anything on you, and you try just to fix your status. So after that, I met my wife in 96, and we got married. I applied in New York. It wasn't actually no problem, but after that I applied for a job in St. Louis. On 97, they accepted me, and I have to move to St. Louis. My job started February 17 of 97. I thought at the same time, you know, why shouldn't switch my case over here and just have the interview happen in St. Louis instead of going back to New York. That too was like a big headache for me, because me and my wife, we was going every week sitting for at least 2-3 hours trying to ask about if the file being transferred, and no answer. A couple months, and after that they said, we received the file, it's okay. I went a week after to say if they opened the file. They say, we're sorry, we misplaced your file, and you should apply from the beginning. I said, okay, I apply from the beginning, and during all this time, I was renewing my work permit. I have my interview March 2nd, 99. Everything went well. At the end of 2000, I was asking suspicion, you know, there is no answer or anything about the green card. They said your case is still under investigation, and they were still renewing my work permit. I think the last month of 2000, they send me a letter. They say my case is being denied, and I have to leave or I have to appeal, which, of course, I appeal. We went to 2001, and it was the same thing, denied and appeal. Everything starts to be breaking so hard on being aggressive after 9/11. It's like 2 months after 9/11. It was another deny letter. I appeal, and at the beginning of 2002, January 30th come and arrest me for my job, take me downtown, and after that, because I'm illegal in the country, which is, I don't understand how I'm illegal in the country. I've been in the country for 9 years, 7 years of them. I'm being married to a U.S. citizen, and as a result of that marriage, I got 3 kids, 6 years old, 3 years old, and 1.5 years, paying taxes like any regular citizen. I haven't been in trouble before, and they still insisting I'm illegal. The same day they put me in jail, in a cell with 3 real criminals, a murderer and 2 drug dealers. It was a long day for me. They got me the next day to the INS again office, because my wife was actually trying to gather the money to pay the bond. It was $1,500. Since that time, she pay, and they give her the running around in the whole day. We need the money order. We need to make sure the money order is okay. We cannot let him go if he's wearing the orange suit, which is, you know, already I wasn't wearing the orange suit. You know, already I've been, you know, I was had the same clothes. I had it the day they arrested me. After that, they told me I cannot work. I asked him how I'm going to support my kids, you know, with no work. He tell me he kept my social security, my ID, and my work permit. Even I asked him for the driver license to at least take my son back and forth for school. He told me this is not my problem. You don't deserve him anyway. And I went home. That time, my wife, she was still working with TWA. It went hard a little bit, but she was still bringing income to the whole family. But it started to be real hard, and actually it was like impossible to make money or payment on the house or the car or anything. December 31st of 2002, my wife was officially laid off from TWA after 17 years working over there. And since that time, almost 8 months right now, it's kind of hard. Anybody hear me or anybody can understand my situation? A regular family, kids, you know, they got their expenses, a house payment, food, insurance, and everything like that. It's kind of hard on me. And during that time, with my lawyer appealing, actually, they told me, you get 4 months and you're going to appear upon the immigration judge, and you should have get your letter. I was waiting for that letter for so long. See, I didn't receive it. I failed to appear in front of the immigration judge, and I have to leave the United States, and you get 30 days to appeal. I appealed. It was in June 2002. It took them 1 year to answer me, and the answer was, according to the first ruling on the judge denying your case, we denying your case too. It seemed like they didn't give me any fair trial or even just give me a justice just to hear my side of the story. I appealed this year of July 2003. 1 day after the appeal, I got a letter from the immigration say my case is being denied again, and they have an arrangement for me to travel back home. Of course, they refused to tell my lawyer when I'll be going to Egypt or what airline, and anything, even after 9 years living in the United States, having almost a regular life over here, they just allow me one bag with 44 pounds. My family won't be allowed to come with me to the airport to say goodbye, and I don't know what I'm going to be doing with my three kids over here left behind. You know, my family will be left behind with nothing.
You can contact the INS in St. Louis at 314-539-2532. That's 314-539-2532 or 2538. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.